talk don't really have much to do with the ADS-CFT correspondence, but I'll try and use a simple example there to illustrate some generic set of tools. But hopefully there's enough of a thematic overlap between the two things for them to belong in the same talk. So let me start with n equals 4 superangles first. As is very well known to everyone here, the idea is to start with the gauge theory and then understand the local composite operators of the gauge theory as states of a quantum spin chain. So the examples that have been discussed in great detail, for example, here are operators which are built out of traces of local composite operators. So for specificity, let me even stick to the SU2 sector. So I have two complex scalars, and then one can associate Z with spin up, W with spin down, put a bunch of Zs and Ws inside a trace, and that becomes an SU2 spin chain. Of course, being the fact that these operators are sitting inside a trace naturally makes the spin chain periodic. And as we have heard from various points of view, that if one looks at the dilatation operator of the gauge theory, then that can be understood, at least as long as one is dealing with closed single trace operators or closed spin chains, the dilatation operator can be understood as an integrable quantum spin chain with periodic boundary conditions. But the gauge theory also has baryonic operators, which are the so-called giant gravitons. These are operators of order n, n being the rank of the gauge group. And these are made not out of traces, but rather out of determinants and subdeterminants. So, for example, the simplest example of a giant graviton is an operator like such. Let us take the Z's, and instead of traces of powers of Z's, one can form the determinant of Z, and this is, of course, a BPS operator being built only out of the Z's. And these non-trivial excitations of the gauge theory, if you like, large operators of order n, are supposed to correspond to the gauge theory dual of various D-brain configurations in the dual gravity theory. So this is, of course, a BPS giant graviton. One can also have non-BPS excitations on top of such a giant graviton-like background. So, for example, one can take out one of the Zs from the determinant and substitute for the Z one of the impurity fields, call it W. And one can also just as well have fermionic impurities, etc. And these would correspond to still BPS giant graviton operators, but carrying more than just a U1 charge. But one can have genuinely non-BPS excitations also. So, for example, one can pull out one of the Zs and put in a whole string of Zs and Ws. So all the operators inside this last parenthesis are multiplied in the sense of matrix multiplication, and their final indices are contracted with the epsilon tensors. So this is this is supposed to be the gauge theory dual of an open string stretching between these three brains. So this is very nice, but these are of course non-BPS operators, and so they will have anomalous dimensions. And the question that is probably worth asking is, can one study the mixing of such non-BPS giant graviton-like operators within the paradigm of quantum spin chains? Now, that is not obviously true, because if you look at these operators, they are operators of order n. And we know that the quantum spin chains emerge in the large n limit of the perturbation theory of the gauge theory. Now, as it stands, it's not even clear that these operators will have a well-defined large n limit, because naively, things that look like subleading processes in the 1 over n expansion may well turn out to be of order 1 simply because of contributions coming from the overall size of the operator. So one has to be a little careful. So one can ask the question, can one have, first of all, a spin chain description for the mixing of non-BPS giant graviton-like operators? And of course, the second question is, If there is a spin chain like description, then is there integrability? Okay. So to answer the first question, one will have to be a little careful. So one starts with normalizing these operators in such a way that their free field two-point function is of order one. So that's a combinatorial problem, and that has been solved by Bernstein and collaborators. So one can work out the normalizations. When one works out the proper normalizations of these operators, one sees, first of all, the emergence of Dirichlet boundary conditions. So when one normalizes these operators such that the free field two-point functions are of order one, one immediately sees the fact that if the first or the last field in the open spin chain is a Z field, then this whole operator factorizes into a BPS giant graviton and a closed string. So it factorizes basically into something that is lower order in 1 over n squared. So just from the normalization, we have the boundary conditions that the boundary fields have to be W's. So those are like the gauge theory, those are the Dirichlet boundary conditions in the gauge theory language. And when one looks at the mixing of these up, and then, of course, one has to ask the question whether or not these operators are closed under dilatation. So one can start with an open spin chain coupled to a giant graviton, and one will have to act on it with the dilatation operator, thinking of this operator as the state of the dilatation operator. And then if these operators go into linear combination of themselves, then everything is okay, and we can start having an open spin chain interpretation for these guys. And that is indeed the case. So at one loop level, the analysis was done by Bernstein collaborators. And the analysis very much depends on the fact that the finite n dilatation operator in the SU2 sector is known to the first few orders, thanks to the work of Weiser, Christiansen, and Staudacker. So this is, for example, the dilatation operator at the one loop level. And so I will omit the epsilon tensors from now on, which make and the z fields, which are contracted with the epsilon tensors, which sort of make up the brain. And one can look at the action of the dilatation operator on the open spin chain, and it turns out that everything is good. So basically, what one gets as the one loop large n dilatation operator is an open spin chain, and the only non-trivial information is that the only non-trivial difference from the closed spin chain sector is that the boundary fields have to be W's. So apart from that, there are no new surprises, and so one has basically a spin chain, a Heisenberg spin chain with Dirichlet boundary conditions. And one can immediately write down a set of beta equations. Now, remember that these are not periodic spin chains, so the magnons can scatter off each other, but they can also scatter off the boundaries, because the boundaries, so they can interact with the brains. So the scattering matrix will have two contributions. The bulk scattering matrix, which is the same as one has for the closed spin chains, and the boundary S matrix. So alpha and beta are sort of the reflection coefficients at the boundaries, if you like, and they contain the information about the boundary S matrix. So one can compute these things and put them inside and once one knows the bulk and the boundary S matrices, one can write down a set of beta equations, which indeed correctly reproduce the energies of the Hamiltonian. One can explicitly show that these bulk and boundary S matrices satisfy factorizability. So the total S matrix of the spin chain does factorize into two-body S matrices. And so there is integrability at one loop level, and it has been also extended. I mean, the original work of Bernstein and collaborators also looked at the full SO6 sector, where too the Meta-Hansa-Rembo spin chain, along with some non-trivial boundary conditions, continues to be integrable. Now, what happens at two loops? And there we encounter some surprises. So one knows from the work of Weiser, Christiansen, and Staudacker the finite n form of the two-loop dilatation operator. One can again do a careful check, and one again finds that at the two-loop level, the mixing of these non-BPS giant gravitons can still be described in the language of open spin chains, so that interpretation holds. No new boundary conditions emerge. the boundary conditions are the same as one had at the one loop level, the Dirichlet boundary conditions, namely that the first and last fields have to be W's. So the two loop spin chain is the same that one had at the closed spin chain sector, only the boundary conditions are different. So although these are operators of order n, their anomalous dimensions are small, and they can still be studied very well in the language of quantum spin chains, and one can work out explicitly the two-loop quantum spin chain. And one can again compute the bulk and boundary S matrices. So the scattering of the magnons from the boundaries is a little more involved. Nevertheless, one can find, once again, the reflection coefficients. The bulk S matrix is the same as one had for the periodic spin chain. So this is, of course, to be regarded as an expression true to the first order in lambda, because we are only talking about a two-loop process here. One can put everything together and write down a set of Bayes equations, and then what one sees is that the spectrum predicted by the Bayes equations is really not the spectrum of the two-loop spin chain. So, in other words, the Bayes equations in the open spin chain sector break down beyond the one loop level, and this is sort of an explicit way to see it. But there's also an intuitive way to understand why the Bayes equations should break down when one looks at giant graviton-like operators. And the intuitive way to understand it is the following: remember that the zero-tension operator is a long-range spin chain, and one of the classical ways to destroy integrability of a long-range spin chain is to sort of abruptly cut the spin chain at two arbitrary points, which is pretty much what the brain is doing. So probably it is not so surprising that the Bayes answer stops working beyond the one-loop order. So that presents us with a puzzle, and probably tells us that other than single phase operators, when one looks at sort of non-trivial large order n excitations, one has to think, be a little more careful, and probably the resolution of these things is going to lead us to some new insights. So this is what I had to say about the deep brains of n equals 4 superanimals, and now let me move on to my second topic, which is about quantum spin chains for bosonic membranes. So this is an attempt to develop a generic set of methods that can be used to study the spectrum of a whole volume theory of membranes in pretty general terms. So let me start by reminding you the classic connections between quantum spin chains and matrix models. So remember that whenever we have a theory of a membrane, we discretize it by using n by n matrices, and basically the problem of evaluating or calculating, computing the quantum spectra of a bosonic membrane at the end of the day reduces to the problem of computing the spectrum of large n matrix models. So let me start with some very simple example where the matrix model has a set of matrices, the conjugate momenta pi's, and some quadratic interaction, quadratic mass term, and then one can have probably some complicated interaction terms. Now, so the Hamiltonian can be written in an oscillator basis. One has a harmonic oscillator bit, and then one can have more complicated things. And the way one computes the spectrum of these guys is basically is by using the same philosophy that we are familiar with in the study of n equals 4 superangles. Basically, one looks at the single phase states of these matrix models and literally interprets them as states of a quantum spin chain with periodic boundary conditions. The energy of the free bit, of the harmonic oscillator bit, can be trivially computed. And when one tries to compute the shifts of the grounds of the energy of the free bits of the Hamiltonian in perturbation theory, one can do so by using techniques of quantum spin chains. And this is a connection that was first worked out by Rajiv and Lee back in 1998, and used recently very, very successfully by Jan Plefka, Thomas Klose, and collaborators in the study of the spectrum of the plane wave matrix model. So the idea is the following. So one has a free bit, a harmonic oscillator bit, to the matrix model, and then one can have some interaction terms, which can, in principle, be very complicated. One looks at the action of the interaction terms on the single trace states, and basically to leading order in the large n limit, when one has an interaction term which is, let us say, quartic, all that interaction term does is to rearrange the spins in the spin chain. So it can literally be interpreted as the action of as the Hamiltonian of a quantum spin chain. So depending on what this tensor is, depending on how the flavor indices are contracted, one can get various spin chains. So for example, if the flavor indices are contracted like this, one will have the permutation operator, and so on. But of course, the crucial requirement for all for this method to go through is that the Hamiltonian have a master. But that is often not the case. So let me give you a very simple example. When one looks at a bosonic membrane, let us say in D plus 2 dimensional flat background spacetime, one has the usual Nambu-Goto kind of an action. And when one does the gauge fixing, when one goes to the light cone gauge, does the gauge fixing and writes down the Hamiltonian, there is a kinetic energy term, there's an interaction term, but there is usually no mass term. So the methods that were very successful in the study of the plane wave matrix model, for example, don't quite work here, at least apparently. But that is not the case, because although classically it looks like this Hamiltonian has flat directions, there have been various studies, numerical studies, and also studies based on WKB methods, etc., of the quantum spectrum of these of matrix models like these, and all of those studies suggest that the spectrum is actually discrete, and there's a mass gap in the spectrum. So can we actually estimate the mass gap and put that mass term here by doing a sort of resum perturbation theory? I'll explain what that is. And in a way, what I'm asking is that can we do an expansion around the quantum corrected effective potential of this matrix model such that a mass term is dynamically generated, and then once we have a dynamically generated mass term, we can use the familiar techniques and connections between quantum spin chains and matrix models to say something about the spectrum. So how do we estimate the mass gap of the model? Well, we do something very naive. We go back to the action, we add and subtract a mass term, and put in a parameter here, call it h bar, which at the end of the day is 1. So we are not changing the theory. The idea is that by adding and subtracting a mass term, we are going to sum over a set of self-energy diagrams, which is going to give us the information about the dynamically generated mass. So how do we do that? Well, we look at the propagator of the theory. The propagator of the theory will have this form. Now, and so sigmas are the self-energy corrections to the propagator. Now, if m squared is indeed the true mass gap of the theory, m is the true mass gap of the theory, then m must be also the position of the pole of the propagator. So if m is the position of the pole of the propagator, then this extra term that we subtracted away must cancel the contribution from the self-energy diagrams, and that in turn gives us a set of gap equations which we can solve order by order in perturbation theory. Now you may ask that, well, this is really a fake perturbation theory because h bar is really of order 1. So how do we know that we are justified in doing so? Because the other contributions, M2 and M3 and so on, may actually be of order 1 as well. So in that case, how do we know when to stop? Luckily, what we see is the emergence of a new expansion parameter. So when one calculates the mass gap, so here is, for example, the two-loop result for the bosonic membrane in a flat D plus two-dimensional space-time. M1 is the one-loop mass gap, which goes as basically the two-loop coupling of the matrix model. And the corrections, this is the second, the two-loop correction to the mass gap, this is actually lower by factors of 1 over d, d being the number of matrices that we have in the problem. It is related to the dimensionality of the background space-time. So in a way, what we are seeing is that the mass gap for these matrix models can be computed in a 1 over d expansion. And so if 1 over 3 is close to 0, 1 over 6 or 1 over 9 is also close to 0, and we can basically trust the leading order term reasonably well. We can also compare explicitly with numerical results that people have found in the comparison. Even the leading order term compares fairly well. Okay, so now we have computed the dynamically generated mass term, and then we can do, canonical quantization around the quantum-corrected effective potential, and now we have a mass term, so we can basically use the same, the familiar connections between quantum spin chains and matrix models. This is kind of different from the perturbation theory that, for example, has been used in the context of the plane wave theory, because the Tuft coupling really scales out of the problem when one looks at the dynamically generated mass. The perturbation parameter mu square is basically related to the mass gap when it is measured in units of the Tuft coupling. So it is basically 1 over d. One can do a similar analysis, for example, for the Myers model, which corresponds to zero brain dynamics in type 2A theory, where there's a Chern-Simons term. The Chern-Simons terms comes from the four-form field strength, and the same ideas go through. So then we can use the standard methods of computing the spectrum of these matrix models using spin chain techniques to look at the one loop spectrum. So, for example, this doesn't work. Yeah. For the top Hamiltonian is the one loop spin chain whose spectrum is the spin chain whose one loop spectrum will give us the one loop correction to the energy of the matrix model corresponding to membrane motion in a d plus two dimensional flat background. The second Hamiltonian is the one that corresponds to the model with the Chern-Simons term. So I, K, and P are familiar things. I is the identity operator, P is the permutation operator, and K is the trace operator. And if one looks, if one has a D plus two dimensional background spacetime, then one has D matrices, and so one has an SOD invariant quantum spin chain. Okay, now question is, are they integrable? Generically, they are not. Because, as we all know from the work of Meenhard and Zaremba, for example, that for spin chains of this sort to be integrable, one needs six matrices. In general, one needs some very specific relative coefficients between the trace and the permutation operator to have integrability, and that works out when one has six matrices. There is an exception to that rule, when one has two matrices that corresponds to membrane motion in four dimensions. And one gets an SO2 invariant spin chain, SO2 because the interaction term is invariant under rotations of these matrices into each other. And we know what the general SO2 invariant spin chain is. It is just the XXZ model, because that is also invariant under rotations in a plane. And so we know the Bessel answers for it. And so one can easily work out the one loop correction to the energy of bosonic matrix models in four-dimensional flat spacetime. One first does estimates the dynamically generated mass and then uses techniques of quantum spin chains. And M square is we are working in the light cone gauge, so the Hamiltonian is really the square of the mass, and so the one loop spectrum looks like this. One has a term which is proportional to J, J being the length of the spin chain. So this is a term that sort of gives us a red J-like behavior. And then one has a term that is independent of J, which depends only on the number of magnons. And then one has 1 over J squared corrections and so on. What happens in general? So like I mentioned, that the case where one has six matrices or when one has two matrices are exceptional cases. What happens in between? The spin chains are not integrable, but can we still say something about the spectrum? And it turns out we can, because even if the spin chains are not integrable, in the limit where the length of the chains goes to infinity, in the large J limit, and sort of BMN limit, they do correspond to Landau-Lifshitz models, which Landau-Lifshitz type sigma models, which are integrable. And one can see that in a little more formal way. So remember that for a spin chain to be integrable, we have to start with an R matrix. For an SON invariant spin chain, the SON invariant R matrix is the following. One has the permutation, one has the trace, and then one also has a factor of G, which is 1 minus N over 2. So this is where the dependence on N of SON comes in. And one can make the transfer matrix by multiplying R matrices together and compute the nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. And the bottom line is that for an SON invariant nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, the coefficient, the relative coefficient between the trace and the permutation operator has got to be 1 minus N over 2 for this Hamiltonian to be integrable. But we also notice, if we actually go back and put in factors of H bar in the R matrix, that this factor G comes with an additional factor of H bar. And the basic idea is that in the large J limit, H bar is roughly speaking 1 over J. So this dependence on G disappears. And all SON invariant quantum spin chains with nearest neighbor interactions correspond to integrable Landau-Lipschitz type models. So one can be a little more formal, go through the derivation, rescale everything so that a large J limit exists, and work out the R matrix, the classical R matrix that corresponds to large J limit. In other words, one can really take the idea that the large J limit is a classical limit seriously, and it turns out that the classical R matrix that one gets at the bottom of the transparency only has no dependence on this factor G. So, which is good. So, another way to see it is that if one starts with a Hamiltonian that has some arbitrary coefficients between the permutation and the trace operator, takes the large J limit, then the relative coefficient basically drops out. And then one has a Landau-Lipschitz model for which one can write down a flat connection, one can exponentiate the lattice connection, get a monodromy matrix, and this is basically the same monodromy matrix that one got from taking the large J limit of the monodromy matrix that one got from the R matrix of SON invariant spin chains. So bottom line is that after all this is done, even though we do not know, even though the most of the matrix models that we get with dynamically generated masses are not integrable, then large J limits always are. So we can say something about the spectrum. And typically, the one-loop spectrum has this kind of a functional dependence. So I'm just I just have here the one-loop correction to the energies of these matrix models. So there's a piece. So there's overall 1 over D dependence. Remember, 1 over D is the effective coupling constant, if you like, of the matrix model. So there's a Regier-type behavior. The mass squared grows linearly with J. There's a term which is proportional to the number of impurities, and then there are 1 over J squared corrections, and so on. All these terms, alpha, beta, and gamma, can be computed model by model, and for most of the models that are of interest, that computation has been done. And so even though we started with a matrix model that didn't look like it could be studied using quantum spin chains, we were able to sort of understand, we were able to combine two methods, one of dynamical mass generation and the methods of quantum spin chains, to estimate some very robust generic properties of its spectrum. One can go further. So, for example, one can proceed a la Gordon Semenoff and collaborators and try and compute finite temperature properties of these matrix models. That is also possible. And at the end of the day, for example, if one looks at the matrix model corresponding to membranes in four-dimensional space-time, one gets this result, the standard result, which is that there is a Hagedorn temperature which is related to 1 over log 2, because we have two matrices, it will be log d if we had in general d plus 2 dimensions. And what I would like to emphasize is that all this is possible because we could estimate the mass gap and put in the dynamically generated mass in the action. Okay. Now, so this was the example that I wanted to use. Now I'd like to just end with a couple of comments about potential applications. So The method that I describe, of course, is not going to work if one has enough supersymmetries in the problem. If one tried to estimate the dynamically generated mass for the matrix theory Hamiltonian, the answer is zero. There is a true flat direction because of standard cancellations between the bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom. However, at finite temperature, and matrix theory computations at finite temperature are of some interest, at finite temperature, one could apply these very methods and study, and then, even in the presence of supersymmetries, there will be dynamically generated masses, mass gaps in the spectrum, and one could use the methods that I outlined in the simple example of the bosonic membrane to study the finite temperature spectrum of supersymmetric matrix models. And the other problem and the other aspect that I'd like to emphasize is the following: that dynamically generated masses are not. We know that generically matrix models that do have mass terms in them, whether they come from some whether they're dynamically generated or are put in there by hand, as long as there are mass terms, they correspond to spin chains, and even if the spin chains are not integrable, we can still say something about their spectrum in the limit of large quantum numbers. And so that philosophy can be used to study mass-deformed matrix models that correspond to supermembranes in various plane wave limits of non-critical supergravity backgrounds. So that is another avenue which is probably worth exploring. So with these comments, let me stop.
We have plenty of time for questions here. So. Yes?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question. So, right. Yeah. There are going to be so these are perturbative corrections, and so there are going to be some self energy diagrams which will have to be renormalized appropriately, yeah.
Other questions? Shall we thank our speaker again?